Music is magic. It's therapy. And it's so, so good for your soul. I am a big fan of clubs and raves, particularly witnessing incredible DJs and the incredible journey they take you on. I had no idea how difficult the industry really is. And today I talk with an amazing DJ that does festivals, high-end clubs, and even spectacular private events. Welcoming Luke Sinclair. In this chat, we go deep into what life is really like for a commercial DJ, how to make the industry work for you, and how the industry has changed since social media. If you are interested in the industry, or even want to be a DJ, this show is not to be missed. Let's go. So Luke, tell me, how did you become a DJ?
So it started rather by accident. I was covering for someone that was not very well at the time, I think.
Okay.
And I was just getting pocket money for doing like roadieing, helping set up speakers and stuff, because I preferred doing that to washing cars. And I was at the time still studying and didn't really know what I was going to do. So I did the gig, and after the end of the gig, I was like, wow, actually, that was pretty amazing. It was to quite an older crowd, but I had a real sort of just kind of natural buzz from it. And this was before any of sort of the dance music stuff that I then grew to love came along. It was just that initial wow. Actually, I felt like I could read a room quite naturally. I wasn't overly nervous, you know, maybe the first half an hour, but then after that, I just kind of got into it. And I guess that's what people feel like, maybe that initial stage fright of, oh, people are looking at me and people are judging me, you know, or, oh, this track's nearly run out. There's lots of immediate pressure when you start to perform as a DJ. But I just kind of was in my head going, it's all right. It's all right if it's not absolutely perfect. Mm. And even at that age, I felt like, okay, this is something that I can definitely explore.
So how old were you?
I was 17.
17?
Yeah. So this will be my 18th year DJing.
Wow. That's amazing. So you said that you could read the room.
Yeah.
So I guess you could see that they were, you know, just dancing and having a really good time. And that back and forth,
yeah,
you know, they see you having a good time and it makes them have a good time. It really is that dynamic when you're a DJ, isn't it?
Yeah. I think at that age, you get confidence after thinking, wow, I've held a room for half an hour without anyone telling me what song to play. So you get a bit cocky, and then you probably play a bit of a curveball, and then you realize, okay, I've gone too far. So you do learn a lot on the job. You can have people advise you with, you know, maybe match a bit of Motown with this, or maybe match this BPM. This goes really well with this. You know, don't do anything that's too dancey for this type of crowd. In the beginning, it's like, it feels like you're just walking a tightrope. But the more you gain confidence with it, and the more obviously experience builds, then you kind of feel bulletproof. You know, if I go and I'll play like a maybe 3 or 4 weddings a year, and I know I can throw in a remix that will work that other people might not, because it's still, they can still relate to it. But it's just something a little bit different. Yeah.
And how do you make the industry work for you?
I would say just taking everything on board, that even stuff that you don't agree with. I know we were discussing off air about having thick skin. That is definitely something that you have to learn. You have to earn your stripes, as it were. And you have to take some knockbacks, take back, you know, maybe residencies lost from managers that didn't quite like the cut of your jib, you know, just like feeling like, well, that's unjust, you know, making sure that even if you disagree with agents or agencies or whatever, maybe they have a specific policy, then sometimes you just have to go, do you know what, it's not worth arguing about it, even though you know you're right. And maybe the reason you've lost work is unjust. You argue about it, it's just going to send more negative vibes, and you might be taken off books. So sometimes you have to take small hits to then go further down the line. This will benefit me because I didn't argue or I didn't say what I really did want to say. You know, save that for your own time. Maybe go to the gym and take it out in the gym. you learn that, definitely. I learned that in my early few years to, you know, particularly to booking agents. They need to please management and venues who are trying to make money as much as trying to please you. You know, over years, there's one agent that I've used for the majority of my time in London. So that's over 10 years. And, you know, I've only met her 3 times in that time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I know that we can have some conversations which veer out into maybe personal, but never too much because it's always been a professional. And I think that if it was anything more than that, it could put what that is at risk.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's just always to be mindful about, you know, if the industry is working for you, just, you know, stay, I know that sounds really obvious, stay professional. Even if you're really tempted to create more personal relationships, just make sure your professional relationships are sound. You know, never, ever not use an opportunity to network and make new connections, particularly if you've just DJed, you're covering for someone. If you're covering for someone and you've met a manager that says, oh, no, it'd be good to have you back another time, you know, don't poach their gig. But, you know, it's always good to have that on the back burner to be like, okay, that's another person I've met that could lead to something else further down the line.
That's something that's really important to know. I mean, you can't cross that threshold, you know, that professional boundary needs to be set early on. And I guess there are going to be times where you're thinking, that's really annoying me what that person did, but you can't say because you can lose that gig. And I think, yeah, like you said, take it out in the gym. That would be good.
Yeah, it just feels like sometimes you have to just have like a word of yourself internally. And this even happened as recently as just after Christmas. I'd helped secure a new residency for an agency. And I think one night I was okay. I think I was working in the afternoon, so I might have been slightly tired, but that didn't, as far as I know, make my performance any worse.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of got a slightly indifferent feeling from a manager that night, and I hadn't met him before. He was usually downstairs working on, I don't know, on his laptop. So I'd never met him. I think he was a slightly higher up manager. And I got the following week, I'd been given a whole bunch of dates for the following month. And then about 4 days after that, I got an email from the agent saying, unfortunately, we've had this feedback from the manager. We can't use you anymore. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was like $2,500. Just like, oh, okay, that's not there anymore.
Gosh.
So it you know, you take hits like that. And I think before, or even for anyone else that's just starting out, I can crush you. You know, you're renting or you're even buying in London and stuff's not cheap. So this is awfully negative.
No, but, it's good because, you know, I think when people are starting out,
yeah,
you can't just rely on the money from that. Does there have to be a bit of a bridging the gap? So while you're starting out, keeping your jobs, not just going all into DJ, but it's all part of it. And, you know, that's why I love this podcast, is because, you know, when we go to a rave or a gig, we're listening to the music, we're watching the DJ, and that's as far as our mind goes.
Yeah.
But it's good to actually go behind it and go, oh, you know, there's a lot that goes on. And with booking agents, I mean, it's not something that you'd think about.
Yeah.
How do you get the bookings then? Is it like you're out on a night out and you meet people, there's networking events and get booked that way?
Yeah, so there are networking events. I've not had a load of success through those. I think some people have for maybe specific genres. I know that a lot of people, particularly in like the drum and bass industry,
mm-hmm.
when you go to like a conference like ADE or the BMC in Brighton, you get big groups, and those networking events, you know, it's very kind of not clicky, but just like, you know, everyone's kind of on it, and mm-hmm. They will have gigs in the diary. But from like a professional full-time DJ perspective, I went to a couple of events hosted by DJ City, And a lot of DJs have used those in the past for downloading remixes, and there's a whole community sort of built within that brand. So a lot of those DJs that are already had been to a few had already kind of got the upper hand. But as far as networking goes, I find that particularly in Amsterdam, every time I've gone to ADE, Amsterdam Dance Event, shout out those guys, by the way. Absolutely love them, love what they do. It's such a well put together week. You ask many DJs in the industry and it's like, it's just like a go-to every year now. It's like, I'll see you next year. It's really great. And there's something for everyone there. And you come back with, you know, not just new contacts, new friends, people that are on exactly the same journey as you, people that might be having the same struggles with you. You know, oh, I've got these tracks, but I can't get them signed. Or I've loved my DJing, but I'm just struggling to get those gigs that I really want. You know, and it's feeling like you're all in it together makes you stronger in a way.
Nice community.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, it's something that I feel like you make the industry work for you when you feel bulletproof. You have to, emotionally, it can be extremely draining. And it can be testing at times financially, especially when you're starting out, because you feel like you've put your faith in one person or one booking. And you think that might be a sure thing. But until you reach a certain point, and even now, 18 years down the line, as I said, even a few months ago, you can be a big part in helping create a movement within an agency, or even just sort of building up a new vibe if a venue's deciding to go in a new musical direction. There might be just something that doesn't go your way that time. And so make it work for you by just, you know, getting yourself out there, you know, yeah, definitely go out to places and speak to a manager. If there's places locally in your area or in a big city, you know, yeah, definitely put the hours in of networking, even just popping in somewhere, you know, even for just a drink, or not even a drink, just to say, oh, I just really love the vibe in there. You know, can I leave my card, or is there anyone I could be in contact with? And you never know where that might lead in the future.
Definitely. Seize every opportunity.
Yes.
Definitely. There is always an opportunity to network, isn't there? Even if you're just going to the local coffee shop, you just never know who you're meeting.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that you meet them and they've been like a resident somewhere for a long time. And it's because a friend has just popped in there before and gone, oh, I think you'd be really good for that. And it's just kind of fallen into their lap. And that's amazing, because then you're kind of like, you know, you've already got that kind of in. So, you know, it can happen unexpectedly. It can happen through an agency all of a sudden picking up some different venues. But yeah, you do have to make your own luck, though. I would say that never be reliant on just waiting for gigs to come, because you could be waiting a while.
Yeah. What do you love most about being a DJ? How does it feel when you're up there?
Yeah, let's talk about the love.
Let's talk about the love.
I mean, still from like right from the beginning, I feel like the reaction you can get from, whether it be, you know, just making someone's, like, you know, if I do a wedding, for example, or even just a birthday gig, a private, you know, function, and people can see that you're experienced, but they don't know anything about you, because, you know, you've just been booked from an agent, but the agent said, you know, Luke is, you know, got lots of experience, but still they're wowed at the end, because I think some people can just be like, oh, we've got a DJ, but it's just a DJ. Mm-hmm. Whereas a DJ can be the difference. I think a lot of people take that for granted, particularly when booking stuff. I've noticed now, obviously, with the usage of Spotify and SoundCloud, people think that's enough.
Oh, putting a playlist together.
Well, yeah, I actually got sent, or I saw something on Facebook from a friend that was quite, it made me chuckle, which was checklist for securing your music for a wedding or event. Don't book a DJ, create a playlist, you know, welcome guests into the venue. And I think the last one was watch people leave the venue after an hour because there's not an atmosphere. Do you know what I mean? Because it does make a huge difference. And sometimes, you know, you need someone to just sort of kickstart that. You know, I think that's still the great thing about it, is that I remember meeting one guy in the industry that said, when it's going well, we're being paid to show off. And I was like, it's so true, because you get like a big cheer off the back of a great transition or something. You know, you drop in a track that I made this little sort of re-edit for myself, which was Lip Sync Funky Town. And I went into the Bee Gees. And I sort of did it so that it goes straight into the big hit of You Should Be Dancing. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that what it's called? I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
But yeah, that one. And with a bit with the horns.
Yes.
And I made like a re-edit of it. And every time I play at a wedding, no one's expecting it to come in. So you get that, wow, great. And I think it's stuff like that. If you love your DJing, you love your music of all kinds, and you can sort of make little moments like that on the dance floor, that's the difference between a lot of DJs that have worked in the industry for a long time. A gig's a gig. It equals X amount of money. Money at the end of the week equals this amount. And it's a business. Whereas for me, it's a business, but it's a business I still absolutely love, whether it's doing a big club gig or it's doing a gig like that. Obviously, on the flip side of that, there's some gigs where you do really earn your money, because, you know, you can just find sometimes that the crowd is quite difficult, or maybe one person is quite difficult. That's part and parcel of it, you know. And that's another thing about being thick-skinned, is that if you've had a real tough night and someone's tried to make it tough and has perhaps, you know, like in the crowd, and they're trying to sort of make other people sort of not rate you, and you can sort of see them in the corner of your eye. You do see that sometimes.
Bitter.
Where yeah so, or sometimes they've had a few drinks and maybe their track wasn't played straight away and they're a bit stroppy about it, or you can get that. And then sometimes it's just, you know, you've just got to kind of bear it and just go, okay, like it's fine, because at the end of the day, not everyone has, I'm sure there are some people out there, maybe they're not telling the truth, but some people out there, they're going to have bad days at work too. Most people, you know, are going to have bad days.
Mm.
Whether you're working in an office or whether you're working as an astronaut, there's going to be some days where you're going, oh God, you've had a bad day.
Yeah.
So for me, I think you could easily take it personally, and you can easily snap and go, you know, why are you being a not very nice person to me? But you know, like a parent's advice, rise above it, maybe not even laugh it off, because that could be stoking the fire a bit, but just get your head down, finish the gig, and then go to the gym and take it out on the gym again, or even in the car. I find myself, I don't know, do you talk to yourself a lot?
I do. You saw me doing it when I was setting up.
Yeah, true. So there's lots of times driving home, you know, just on the motorway, and I'll be going to myself, do you know what? This is what I would have said. You're just a horrible person. You're not a very nice person, actually. You're just trying to bring the whole mood down. And what for? It's not even your night. It's your friend's birthday. And that will go on for a minute, and then I'll go, okay, I've got that out.
Yeah, that's good, actually. You can just have the conversation with the imaginary person, get the feelings out.
Yeah.
It's good. But it's good to get that out, but also focusing on those moments that keep you going, those moments where you're surprising the audience with that change of song.
Yeah.
I mean, when I go to a rave, they are the moments that make me feel like I'm buzzing for days and days afterwards, is those little nuggets. Those magic moments where you just don't expect that track to come in, and you're just going, oh my God, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And it is amazing to feel that. Must be amazing to see everybody's reactions like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You feel like, you know, you put a lot into sort of the preparation for it. And, you know, as I said, I've done this for quite a long time now. There'll be times where I do a lot of gigs in sort of Mayfair and stuff like that, and you're playing to lounges rather than dance floors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be easy to feel a little bit unencouraged by some of the reactions, but that's okay, because that could be just a lounge bar. You're playing tracks which are stuff for just like head nods and foot tapping. You might get people starting to dance around the tables. That's a great night if that happens. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, you know, the people that are there are usually there just to have a nice chat and drink a nice cocktail, look at a beautiful view outside of a rooftop. And again, I think a lot of people could become disillusioned with the industry because of that, because it's like, oh, well, this is not what I want. But you're in a very privileged position to play in a high-end venue to people. More often than not, you'll have the bar staff who are usually lovely, because they're having to, you know, provide this service to a lot of people that might not give them much communication. Mm-hmm. Not bad-mouthing the Mayfair crowd, by the way. Love them all. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, and so I've made a lot of friends through that, and you might walk in and you'll get a hug. And, you know, there was a time, no, I know we were talking about like sort of drinking a bit earlier. There was one venue that I have played for sort of ever since lockdown finished. And I'd walk in and they'd have like a James Bond martini waiting for me, which is lovely.
Yes.
It's like, because they know I'm about to arrive and it's there waiting for me next to the DJ booth. And I thought, this is a nice touch. This is also a habit, which is, it's like, oh, okay. And then it actually got to a point where I was like, oh, actually, I'm not going to have a drink tonight. And they were like, oh. So it was kind of like, you know, they were just really sort of, like sort of trying to make you as home as possible. And those are gigs as well where you might not get that feeling on the dance floor because there's not one, or, you know, you might put a lot of effort into a set, but you're not getting that feedback off the dance floor.
Yeah.
That can be disheartening, but just remember the privileged position that you're in, because you're getting paid well to pretend, you know, play basically any music you want within a certain spectrum. You know, house, disco, house, funk, soul, you can kind of take it in any direction you want, because at the end of the day, you're just playing nice background music.
Yeah.
But gigs like that, you know, you've got a beautiful backdrop, you're surrounded by friendly people. So it's good. It's good to take the positives out of gigs like that.
I mean, even like when I go to places, some freedom's just in my mind, but they have the DJ, but it's guest considered background music, but I love the good background music. So you can sort of bob as you're having your espresso martini or whatever you
is
like.
Is that
drinking.
Freedom Soho?
Yes.
Yeah. Shout out Keith.
But it is a really good place to have.
Yeah. I've had some absolutely blinding nights in there. Unbelievable nights in there.
Me too.
Yeah. I have to say, gay LGBTQ plus crowds that I've played, among the best nights I've ever had as a DJ. Because it's just like, particularly in that downstairs in Freedom, there was one night where the crowd was like this, and it just, the levels did not drop all night. It was absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
I love nights like that when you're not expecting it, but then when it happens, you're just kind of like, whoa, yeah, can I play here every week?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's all about just taking those moments when you can. Obviously, if you're like, you get to that certain level where your brand, for example, my Lucas Solis brand isn't at the level that I want it to be yet, I still have my goals in mind. And those goals, you know, I hope to achieve sort of within the next 3-4 years. But before that, it's just making sure you make the absolute most out of those moments when they do come along.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So you have two aliases. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah. So the first one's Lucas Solis. And that's the sort of the main one, the one that's been going the longest. I started that up just because the transition from when I was doing sort of a lot of gigs in the West End in London, and I had met a few, I'd already started sort of really loving house music at that point. I'd started collecting a few bits and pieces, and I still had my turntable decks back then. And I just knew that I needed to have a separate project so that then I could create something which was a complete sort of concept for a club. And so then I can separate that from the commercial side, so that when people book a Lucas Solis DJ set, they know that it's going to be like a sort of very Balearic sort of big room, hands in the air experience.
Lovely.
So, you know, and that can that can be house, tech house, or even techno or progressive house in the beginning. And so that kind of led to me thinking, okay, that's great. I actually started a sort of disco project on the side, which ran for about, I think, about 18 months. So then I was doing a lot of disco sets as Lucas Solis as well, and that didn't quite feel right. Mm-hmm.
So sort of blending, was it, between your
aliases? Yeah, well, then I, you know, I'd be talking to people that are doing the artwork, or the guy that I ran the disco event with at the time, Tom. I said, you know, I feel like I need another alias for that, to then just to differentiate from that. Mm. And I know a lot of DJs do that. Like, for example, Eats Everything. He has his DJ sets, which can be quite sort of chunky and bass heavy house and quite gritty sounding, Chicago sounding. And then he'll go and do like a disco set, and it will say on the lineup, you know, Eats Everything disco set. For me, I thought that I could do that, but because my sound, the Lucas Solis sound, is very sort of Balearic and very driven, it felt weird to kind of have that and then such an opposite in terms of the disco music that I was playing. You know, to go from something like a techno heavy, sort of really sort of big, wide, big room track. Mm. And then someone to see me as Lucas Solis, then playing a track which has got Diana Ross on it.
Yeah, I can't imagine that working.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, it, I still do gigs now where I suppose it's like a hybrid of the two. Yeah. So if I'm playing a gig in London and they want like a commercial house, I might throw in a little bit of kind of like tribal, or throw in a bit of disco, and just kind of have all three: commercial house, Balearic-y vocal, Ibiza house, you know, Kings of Tomorrow, and then go back to, you know, your Arethas and, you know, even a bit of funk, even a bit of Motown. Mm. All of that sort of thrown in is great, because then it's like constant curveballs. So yeah, going back to the aliases, the second one is called El Arpa. That was actually born off of a double act that I started with Tom, who I ran B53 with. I met lots of people in the industry that were like, yeah, I think that's definitely a good idea. And we played a few gigs as the double act, but we went in separate directions. And then off the back of that, I thought it best to rebrand again, start fresh with new socials. And that's very, both, I guess, very specific. And I take real enjoyment out of sort of finding those rare gems for both aliases that I'm like, yeah, that's definitely that. That one's definitely an El Arpa track. And that one's definitely a Lucas Solis track. And I feel like people can hear that in the music. You know, I'm not just going for the obvious Beatport top tens. I'm finding those things that I just think, oh yeah. Or I'm reaching out to people online and saying, I would love the digital of this, and it's only released on vinyl. I've done that quite a lot, actually, because then you know you've got something that not a lot of people have got.
That's good.
Yeah.
So what's the difference musically between the two?
So Lucas Solis is, I would say, you know, more sort of clubby, mm-hmm. More sort of big room vibes, lots of sort of big hands in the air vibes. I do a lot of work with a brand called Sunrise Sessions. I've gone out to the States with the Lucas Solis brand.
Wow.
And the Americans, they really seem to love it. They're kind of going through like a house music renaissance at the minute, which is great. I think a lot of the people, particularly where I've played in the Midwest, they hear Chicago house and they've heard it for 30 years. And it's great. I did actually go to this gig in Chicago and I was like, I danced like I'd never danced before. Like, you know, everyone in the room was, the whole room is like, I don't know how to describe it, but no one was standing still. So from like a higher level, I was looking down and it almost looked like sort of like a sea of worms. That sounds really weird to say, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where just everything, nothing is still, and like heads are moving and swaying.
Mm-hmm.
I sweated my butt off that night. Like, in a totally innocent way, may I add, I'd had two beers, but it, just because the energy in the room, mm. and it was just like this really amazing kind of and the speakers weren't like perfect. There was a bit of crackle. So it was very like, it was very Chicago. It's very gritty, you know, and everyone was just absolutely going for it.
Sounds amazing.
And for me, that was because it was the first time that I'd ever experienced something like that in Chicago, which is obviously arguably the birthplace of house music. Some people say New York. I'm pretty sure it's Chicago, but tender topic. But I guess Americans are looking for something a bit different. There's a lot of those gigs going on all year round in America. Now they're kind of picking up where we were, where disco is now huge again. And also different types of house. So when I was in the States for the first time, I did a set and there were lots of people that hadn't really heard my style before. And with the Lucas Solis brand, the builds are quite intense. You know, you can get to a bit where there's sort of 32 bars of it just slowly intensifying. And people are kind of like,
the suspense,
because a lot of the drops particularly in the States can be quite sort of bass heavy but quite quick.
Okay,
you'll have like a little riff in the track that will say something and then bang, it's straight into the kick, whereas a lot of my builds I feel like it's quite strung out, you know, really add the effects in there, make it as intense as possible so that when it finally drops it's like bah. And so I think a lot of people are like, wow, this is like the first time I'm experiencing that.
I love that. And definitely when I'm at a rave, that is the bit when it's like the music's intensifying and you're waiting for it to drop, but you're really enjoying that moment right before it.
Yeah.
And then when it does, it does something to
you. Well, the lights go up and everyone's hands in the air and you can see the whites in people's eyes where they're going, like the shock of it, because it's like, can it get any more intense? Oh, it is getting more intense.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why, we were talking about like set prep. There's a lot of DJs that I know that will have folders ready for gigs, but they like to adapt as they go. I have done that if I know that there's a set that maybe a DJ before me has gone in a completely different direction to what I expected. Then you have to adapt.
Yeah.
But for the gigs that I've played in the States with Summarized, I'll kind of know, depending on what time I'm playing as well, obviously that's quite important. Mm-hmm. I really like to sort of take my time with the building, like the sort of foundation of the set, those first three or four tracks, just getting people nicely going, not going too hard straight away. And then by track five, you know, you've got them where they're just kind of like, okay, they're vibing with this. And I know we were talking about holding on to that crowd is part of the challenge. You can feel like, you know, these tracks have got to be perfectly aligned, like a jigsaw puzzle, or like, you know, just like links in a chain.
Yeah.
That's got to make sure that, you know, by the time you're at track five or six, that the people are there and they've made the decision to stay in your room if you're in a multi-room venue, or not to go outside for a cigarette, or not to go to the bar for another round. Or they can, but they're going to come straight back.
If you're really thirsty, go.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you mean, though. I've actually been to several events where the set is that good that my phone doesn't come out. I've actually been at a point where I'm like, I must tell my friends to come into this room, but I couldn't even get my phone out because I felt like I was missing it. Wouldn't go to the bar. You're just like, I'm staying here. I ain't going anywhere. Mm. And it's so amazing when you feel that way. But yeah, there are times when you go, okay, I'm going to go and get a drink or something like that. And it's not always the DJ's fault. It can be that you just thirsty or need a wee.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. Like to have them on that sweet spot, that journey, that captivating state, it's unbreakable when you get that.
Sometimes it's difficult because there might be a couple of tracks where you know that it's a good transition, but there might have been more energy in the track before. And then you have to sort of try and replicate that energy in that track. So you might have to start it a bit later on. But also people are human. And if they're dancing nonstop for half an hour, after half an hour, they're going to be like... But the point is then to, in some sets, give them a little breather, just let them vibe, give them a little breather before the next big bit comes in. That can also be as important. Because if you've got literally just, you know, an hour or even more than that of just drum rolls and people are like,
It's a bit too intense, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a fine line, and I take real... I find that so much fun. Like getting that sort of... I don't know if this is... I've spoken to other DJs. I think a lot of DJs go down the folder route and go, I think I'll play this, but I'm not 100%. Usually I've done about 4 or 5 drafts of what that set's going to be. And I won't know until usually the day or the day before. That's my set list. So like, and then something might creep in at the last minute and go, do you know what? That track that I haven't played in a while, that's going to work. So then you have a last minute. But yeah, I'm very meticulous with it. And I find it almost as enjoyable as the gig. Because then you can just kind of, I'll be there with my little AirPods in on my laptop, just on my settee going, and just imagining that I've got the crowd in front of me. Yeah. And that, for me, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's going to work. And it's almost like, I feel like a sort of a crazy professor, like making like the perfect potion, like, like I feel like sometimes that's what you feel like. You feel so like, it takes over you. The music takes over you and you just feel like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to stop until this is absolutely perfect.
Yeah. Sounds amazing. It's almost like, yeah, a masterpiece that you're creating. And I love what you said about like sort of the fine line, that balance. There are times where someone's done, you know, a bit of a lull and then dropped again. And I've gone, I really needed that.
Yeah.
Really needed that time to just almost reset, still be on the journey, but just reset a little bit in my mind.
Take a breath.
Yeah. But I'm just picturing you sat, you know, imagining you've got your audience. And,
yeah.
But it's a really good way to think, because you're not just thinking, that's a great track. That's a great track. But you're like, this is going to work with this. This is the emotion that I'm going to create. And it is a jigsaw puzzle. It really is.
Yeah, it is. It's, I think, you know, a lot of it can be trial and error as well. When you just think, like if you play a festival, sometimes a track might go down really well in open air, but then in a club, it might just sort of not hit on the same. Okay. So then there'll be some times where you might lose a chunk of a crowd and you go, oh, okay. So it's your job to get that chunk back, or just, you know, try and at least just stay on that even keel and just be like, okay. So yeah, sometimes it isn't always perfect. It doesn't always work out. I think I've been very lucky over the years to play some club sets where my set time's really good. And I've started out at the gig that I've done in Brixton for a few years in a row, at the Prince of Wales. They're all outdoors, and then I open up the club room, and so you start off with maybe the one person you've walked down the stairs with, you know, and then after, that's usually a 2-hour set. And within half an hour, you're just starting to get people trickle in. And that can be huge, because they might trickle in after a day of dancing outside in the sunshine and go, oh no, should we go home? You know, should we go get KFC? Do you know what I mean? Should we go, other chicken shops are available, by the way. Should we call it? You know, because a lot of people love an early, myself included, love an early finish. Absolutely love an early finish. So then you're just kind of like, okay, but these people still want a party. So let's give them it, but let's not overcook it too soon. So that is absolutely a jigsaw, because you're feeling like this bit is going to be the bit where you win them over. The next bit is the bit where you take them to the next level, and you make sure that they're like, bang, totally into it. Yeah.
Just quickly, while I have your attention, if you can please make sure you subscribe, as it really, really does help to boost the show. Thank you all so much. All right, let's get back to it.
So I haven't done like a 3-hour club set in a long time. And, it's a long time, but it's something I feel like a lot of DJs, I mean, we're all selfish buggers, but you know, but to do like a 3-hour set or even an all night long, to create like the longest journey, and do, you know, there's lots of masters who are, yeah, there's a guy, Dixon. Have you ever seen Dixon play?
I don't think so.
I've seen him play like an all night long, like a 6-hour set twice. And both times it's just, he is an absolute magician at what he does, because he starts off so slow and the BPM ends about 30 beats per minute faster than what he started with.
Wow.
So he's even transcending from different music genres, like starting with really kind of like ambient house, which isn't really even house music because it's nowhere near like a 4/4 beat. and then just really slowly going up and up in the beats per minute, but still keeping it on brand, and then ending up with just like really sort of fast, intense kind of breakbeaty stuff that people have just been striving for, because he's just, you know, he's building it ever so patiently.
Taking his time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to do something like that would be, yeah, I would love to do that.
So I was just thinking, like, would some of it be pre-recorded sets? But I guess you would just choose your, well, I guess with some tracks, they're so long that you can go, like, I'm just dying over a second.
Yeah.
But yeah, that must be amazing. But even 3 hours, that is a long, long time. Yeah. I think I've only ever known people to do a maximum of 2.
Yeah. Well, going back to like the commercial sort of world of DJing, when I started out, particularly over Christmas time, you know, you do some corporate events, you're there at 5 o'clock and you might not leave until 3, you know.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yes.
And obviously there's lots of people that for a long time probably thought that my DJing was, you know, oh no, are you still doing the DJing? Are you still, okay, not going to do anything? Are you going to get a proper job? No. Do you know what I mean? Just
proper
like,
proper job.
Well, yeah, just yeah. Not taking it seriously as I was taking it. And that's probably just because from an outside eye looking in, you don't know how you can sustain it. So I guess that's understandable, quite naive to have that view on it. But it, you know, it is tough sometimes. Those long sets that I did, I haven't done a set that long in a while. But you have to go through that. You know, that's like a bottom rung of the ladder. Playing in the West End, you know, playing venues which might not be the nicest, sticky floors for not a lot of money, you know, you just to get yourself out there, you know, and then someone might notice you on the back of that gig and you might get another gig. But I feel like a lot of people when they started out, that's what they were doing, you know, either that or doing like social clubs and, you know, private function venues, you know, just on with a couple of little twinkling lights, you know. I think we everyone that's my age, my generation, probably started with that, you know, and just sort of bedroom DJing as well. But to take it to that next professional level, getting an agency, yeah, lot of DJ sets where you're like, okay, the money's good, but the hours are, you know. So then, yeah, then you do need bathroom tracks because you can't.
I can imagine that, putting brackets on a bit of paper. Bathroom track.
Yeah. There's a guy that we did very similar gigs in the West End. We, you know, obviously never got to see much of each other because we were always DJing in different venues, but we'd always have a catch up. A small group of us would meet up in like the Hippodrome or
one
of the casinos on like a Tuesday night, because it's like, right, none of us are working. Let's go somewhere where none of us work, where we can, and so I don't think any of us actually gambled. We just would sit sort of round the bar in the casino and just chat. And it'd be quite refreshing to know that you're in it together. You know, you're not, but you are, because you're both sort of experiencing the same amounts of fatigue, hunger. This one guy in particular, he used to bring like a full picnic with him to gigs.
Really?
Yeah, like during Christmas time, he'd be like, yeah, so a few hours, then I'll have my starter, you know, my Tesco's meal deal.
Oh.
And then a few hours, and then I'll have my lunchbox with my couscous and salad, and, you know, then before the end of his set, like a protein bar and a milkshake, you know, he'd do the full shebang, which I did try and get into that, but then I don't think anyone wants to see a DJ sort of tucking in, do you know what I mean? Like constantly. So yeah. I'd try and just eat like one massive meal and then just have snacks. I think if you're going to do it where you can eat something easily behind a DJ booth.
Yeah, I can't imagine couscous being
flying around. Yeah, exactly. That's quite, and if you've got like a little plastic fork or something,
gosh, yeah.
You know, so it's do stuff that's, you know, maybe one of those yogurts in a tube. Power bar. Yeah, always have power bars. Yeah. Love anything those. That's easy. I remember I went through this phase actually of going, do you know what's really easy to eat and just that I can eat just quite sushi? So I used to get sushi. I used to get sushi because I was like, at least then I don't have to get like chopsticks out, you know.
Yeah.
I was literally just a few tracks, a couple of bits of sushi behind the DJ booth, back into it. And even if someone saw me reappearing and like, I'd be like, you know, just Because I'd feel unprofessional. Even though I'm starving, I'm like, I'm allowed to eat. It's my right to eat. But yeah, and some people have worked restaurants where they'd have like a pizza alongside the DJ booth. I could never get with that. Because you just kind of, you'd have to pass it off as, oh, I do this all the time. You know, I'm DJing. And there's people looking at you and just kind of taking a big slice of pizza. For me, it never quite sat with me.
Like, you'd have to change your DJ name to something foodie.
Yeah, yeah. Eats everything. Part two. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite? I mean, what I'm getting is that your favorite is like the rave festival type thing where you've got a bigger crowd, where you can create that emotion more than a nightclub in Soho.
I think they're very different feelings, I think. I feel like sometimes in the commercial sphere, you can have times where you've surprised people by maybe going in a different direction. And that's always nice because then they might be like, you know, do you produce or do, you know, do you have Instagram? I'd love to hear like your club stuff.
That's great.
Yeah. Mm. So that's like, oh, I've gained a fan. You know, you sort of can sort of transport people to maybe they didn't realize they enjoyed house music or that Balearic style or, you know.
I guess it's a more intimate feeling, isn't it, in those gigs?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people, particularly sort of, you know, how Ibiza is these days, a lot of people can go to Ibiza and maybe go to O Beach or go to like day parties where it's not hugely about the music. You can have like a nice little vibe there, but a lot of the music can be commercial, a lot of sort of remixes, lots of stuff that you've already heard before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as a customer, it's an easy win because, you know, you get a bit merry and you sing, I don't know, house every weekend or whatever it is, and you have a great time with your mates, but you're not challenging yourself to then maybe going and hearing a DJ and going, oh, actually, do you know what? I prefer this. This is amazing. And I've had that before with certain events where, people haven't realized that they actually enjoy more Balearic house, which isn't, you know, like a remix of a club classic. You know, there's so many of those doing the rounds these days. Yeah. It's hard to avoid. So yeah, there's that. But I would say my absolute favorite, is definitely that club atmosphere. You know, getting people sort of in the palm of your hand. You know, making sure that you've given them that experience, which they're not going to forget. And you know, when you do gigs like that, you can find 6, 7, 8 DJs on a lineup and you'll hear other DJs and go, God, that was good. Mm-hmm. That was really good. So that makes you want to up your game. You know, that makes you want to go, not that it's a competition, but you want to show what you're made of.
Yeah.
For other DJs to respect you and go, you know, Lucas Solis set, you know what you're in for. We know he's done it before. And you know, just making sure that product is as good as it can be.
Yeah, definitely. So what's the biggest compliment you've ever had?
Biggest compliment I've ever had? I did one gig in, I believe it was somewhere in the States. I think Chicago, or it might have been Indianapolis. And yeah, as I said, the music that I play was probably a bit different to what they were used to, definitely different to the DJ that was playing before me.
Right.
And there was a girl that was, you know, she was putting hands on her heart like the whole set and was just like, you know, doing like mind-blowing sort of like looks at me. And I was like, this is great. You know, she's really loving it. And everyone's kind of vibing off her as well. And at the end, I remember her saying like, oh, I'm like physically and emotionally spent. And I was like, amazing, like mission accomplished, because that's kind of what I set out to do, for people to like, after my set, go just sigh and go, that was an experience, you know, rather than just that was a guy who just put a few tracks together. That's, you know, that's what I always would want to leave people with.
It was her therapy.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. I remember going to an Above and Beyond gig. But were you there?
I wasn't there.
No?
No, I don't think so.
I'm going back a few
We've known each other for how many? It's been like 9 years now, yeah. But I don't think I was there.
Yeah. Your other half was.
I think. Possibly.
Yeah. But yeah, and I remember them, their slogan for a while was group therapy.
Yes, I've heard of this.
And,
yeah.
And it was something that was quite, you know, and the trancier stuff, some of it isn't my bag. Some of it I really loved because then it sort of transcended into more progressive sort of vibes and sort of like 80s synthy kind of like nice. Real nice feeling. That's yeah. My cup of tea. Mm. So, you know, there were moments where I was just like looking at people and eyes closed, almost in a meditative state. Is that a word?
Meditative.
Yes,
it is. It just sounds
funny. Yeah. Sounds like you're stuttering. Yeah. So yeah, that was like a therapy.
Yeah.
So I would say that I kind of gleaned a bit of inspiration from that, thinking like, yeah, this can be someone's escape for an hour or 2 hours, yes. where they can just have that feeling of total, like, you know, like you said, not needing to look at your phone, just being in that moment, having a great time,
yeah.
going absolutely wild. And then afterwards needing a lie down.
Yes.
'Cause you're just like, that's what I needed.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah.
And it is amazing. I mean, this dancing is definitely, you know, not, I mean, in the ballet, it was all choreographed routines. That's not the same when you're doing freestyle dancing in a club scenario or rave. You're just two-stepping or whatever dance moves you want to do. And it is just, you feel so free and liberated. Yeah, and it does feel, to me and to many other ravers, I'd imagine, therapy. Mm. You really, really need that.
Yeah.
I remember when my brother, he was like, oh, I don't really go to raves. It's not my thing. That's what he used to say. And then I surprised him by taking him to a Paul Van Dyke at Ministry of Sound. And I remember him with his hands up in the air and his eyes closed. And he was like, oh, it's the best night of my life. And I was like, exactly. Because yeah. it's a different yeah. level.
You hear that a few times on dance floors. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, it's definitely an escape. And it's sometimes an escape that I think people didn't realize they needed.
Mm.
The club scene now is very, very different. I feel like, you know, I'm sort of, well, I'm saying to people, I'm still very much in my mid 30s. But you know, sort of in between mid to late 30s, I'm happy to admit that on air. But, you know, that's something that means I've seen a transition in dance floors over the years. I think, I mean, a lot of people that I think were born in the late 80s kind of wish they were born a bit earlier. So maybe they could have experienced that 80s/early 90s, that sort of birth of house music, because the parties from then to now are chalk and cheese.
Yes.
And obviously a lot of that, particularly in most recent years, social media has a big part in that. The percentage of crowds that are using their phones on the dance floor. I know that there's some events now which are saying we have a no phones policy. I'm so behind it.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's good to have. I actually went to a gig in Camden last month with a few friends, and they took the mic because I just put something on Instagram about I'm not going to be posting as much on Instagram, especially just because the sort of clamoring for content is something that I feel like, number one, I know that some people are more natural at it, but I felt a bit of a wally doing it just for, you know, and for two, the time consumption, making a reel, and then I'd make a reel using one of these editing things on your phone. And that's fine. If you've got loads of hours to do that, or you're just happy with going bish, bash, bosh, done, put it out.
Yeah.
I'm quite a perfectionist, and I'd be like, oh, no, it's not quite right. You know, and sometimes you'd be sat on your phone for an hour and then you'd be like, I was going to do this. And and that's on top of looking at WhatsApp and looking at, you know, fancy football, you know, and it's more screen time. And that's something I've tried to get away from in the last year. I didn't make any New Year's resolutions, but I am like a goals person. And I've said that to a lot of people that, I'm trying to bring my screen time down. Just because it's very cheesy to say, but there's life outside of it, you know, I feel like there's a lot to embrace and a lot of people can just be consumed by that. So, yeah, I have seen a change in what that dance floor was when I first started going out to what it is now. I know we were talking a little bit about sort of the image of, yes, of DJs at the moment, and a lot that are being booked on their image. You know, good luck to them. It's definitely something which has saturated the market. It's made it more competitive, particularly for those that, you know, want to get into DJing or have, you know, been through it, you know,
yeah,
DJs that are older than me. It should be about the music.
Yeah.
And it's a message that I feel like, ironically, using socials to get across. But yeah, I going back to what I was saying, sorry, I did take like a 5-second video of this gig in Camden. And a friend of mine took a video of me videoing saying, oh, hypocrite. But it's but the point I was making is there's some people that will just spend their whole night looking, and people that will be going to let's say a venue in Ibiza just for the gram, just for, you know, getting that right camera angle, being sat on a I don't know what they call it a bed, you know, when people order beds, you know, with a bottle with a sparkler hanging out of it. I just, for me, it's not what the house music's about. And that might ruffle a few feathers, but it just seems like it's unauthentic and all about likes on Instagram or TikTok. And you know, a lot of DJs are now being booked because of the content they put out or how many followers they have. And I'm hoping that we'll get to a point where it will come back around, where it should just be about the talent that is coming forward.
Definitely.
And to kind of nicely dovetail that is, I've met a lot of people that are in the industry that were sort of coming up at the same time as me, and they are talented. And not only have they been talented as DJs, they've started to be talented as producers, and that's taken them to new levels, and they've been signed by big record labels. Wow. And they're doing really, really well, and it's so great to see that success, because they deserve it. They deserve it because of those reasons, because they're really, really talented.
Yeah, definitely. I think people are getting very consumed by the phone and what it brings. And I mean, I think there's even like, you can edit how your face looks and the video. Oh, it's just a little bit insane. It's just not reality.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much about, you know, being real. And then there's the Instagram versus reality and all this stuff that people are trying to do. That's great. But that, yeah, it is just keeping everyone very, very contained in this warped reality of what life really is. I mean, when I go out, and my friends will know what I'm talking about, but when they're taking yet another selfie of our night, I'm just like, no, I don't want it. I just want memory.
Yeah.
I want the memory
that
stays in here in my mind. I don't need a really great photo of myself. And I'm not that great at posting on social media. I'll post my podcast, but I'm not really great at doing the other bits because I just don't find it natural, nor do I feel like it's going to make me get to where I need to be.
I feel like it's posting for the sake of posting. I know that a lot of people are saying, got to stay relevant, got to stay on the algorithm. But the more deeper you go into it, the more I feel like, it seems like you'll do anything, you know, and maybe, I mean, a lot of it is fun. A lot of it is sort of dancing around and a laugh, and I get that. But I feel like if you're doing that a lot, or I don't know, you're walking down the street and then, this is a perfect opportunity to do a reel and say hi to my followers. You're getting further and further away from real life, because now everything, a walk across the street has to be a silly walk for the gram, or, you know, eating in a restaurant has to be. Yeah. And, you know, and I just feel like now it's becoming a thing where it's kind of dominating people's lives. And I think it personally, for me, it would be nice for us to go back to how it was, where, you know, people are using socials, but using it in a way where it's just like about what you're trying to be.
Definitely.
Rather than, you know, turning into a fashionista or a comedian. There's lots of people that do those comic posts where they're like miming a famous quote from a film like pointing to something on the screen.
Yeah, you know, it's a trending one, isn't it?
Yeah, and great if you're doing your product, but if you're just kind of going off piece, like it just, I'm not understanding what these people are trying to achieve apart from followers, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's being faithful to your brand, isn't it? And getting out there, but maintaining you authentically, you. And I feel like it has changed. I know we spoke about it before. You know, I think probably it's since the likes of TikTok, where there's so many like templates that you can use, and it's just taking people on different paths. But especially if you're a musician, I mean, I guess if you're an influencer, you need to be taking pictures of food and lots of things. And
of course,
I get that. But when it's music and art, I feel like there is nothing better than just being there in the moment. Documenting it is, it's almost like you want to show people what you've seen, but it's not because you want people to see it, but you want likes off the back of it. That's what's gone a bit wrong, I think.
Yeah, I agree with the sort of intention that it is. Like documenting a really nice memory, you know, absolutely no problem. But yeah, the way some things are edited where it's like, oh, this will get loads of light because look what everyone else is missing. You know what I mean? And I'm feeling like that people will do that, and there's a lot that will maybe get a gig where someone else would be better suited to it, but someone's got the gig because of maybe an algorithm or how many followers that they've got. And I don't know if, you know, people that sort of get 10,000 followers out of nowhere. I know that you can have spikes on TikTok and Instagram. I've never really looked that far into it, but it's definitely a head scratcher for me, because it's like, well, okay, but you know, surely that there's, you know, if you can do it organically and gain recognition from it organically, focus on the music, focus on the content that is relevant to your music or your product or whatever you're doing. There's more dignified, it's a bit more dignified, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. And going back to the meeting people organically and the networking, that's the better way to do it anyway. You don't have to do it through TikTok and social media. You can just do it through the power of being you, making sure that your sets are on point, being dynamic, being an artist, not being something that you view on a flat screen.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where there's been a lot of kind of uproar in the industry about the birth of this, you know, DJ / influencer, because now it's kind of like anyone could be a DJ because they've got the sync button. You know, that's a whole other can of worms. Yeah. You know, that can really get people's backs up, and probably rightly so, because, you know, these people are taking these DJ sets and probably getting paid really well for it, but at the end of the day, they're not actually DJing, or they could have just have a mix on and just kind of doing a dance of whatever routine that they've got, dance routine. But it's like, I just feel like if you're good at dancing, like dance, but there'll be a DJ out there that could absolutely crush that set, and it's kind of making a bit of a mockery of it. And I've had a discussion about Paris Hilton once with someone online that really didn't like the way I'd sort of said to her, but, you know, sort of described how she's kind of put a negative effect on the DJ world. And it's just because, you know, there's been evidence of her with pre-recorded sets, or someone behind the DJ booth actually doing the mixing while she just stands there pretending to listen. You can Google that. And that's kind of snowballed. But I did come back to it and say, but if you are a great DJ, I've seen Gok Wan play, cracking DJ.
Yes.
Really enjoyed his set. And he knows his stuff about house music because he was DJing before that. But it's the people that actually still can't beat match and are just deciding to do celebrity sets or influencer sets, you know, in these clubs. And I feel like, you know, for the venues, it's a difficult position for them because they need to sell tickets. But then, my message to these influencers and these people would just be, before you come into our industry, learn our industry a bit, because otherwise, yeah, it's gonna leave kind of a sour taste in a lot of DJs' mouths, I think. Do yourselves justice. If you've managed to get that platform from where you're gonna be booked for $5,000 for a set which deserves a little bit more effort than you're putting in,
yeah.
Put in the effort.
Go in as a blank canvas, willing to learn a new trade, you know?
Yeah.
I think that as a friend of mine on a podcast recently saying, you know, when you're, even if you're a dancer in one field, but you're going into a different genre, blank canvas, go in fresh, willing to learn. And I think you have to do that of any industry. You can't go, well, I'll hang on to the followers and the celebrity aspect. You know, you need to go in fresh and almost leave that at the door. You know, I think that would help massively. But again, you know, it's the phones. Would you say it's that's the most challenging part of the industry you're in today?
I would say the biggest challenge, particularly with sort of like the modern industry, is the fact that a lot of the booking agents you see a lot of the same lineups, particularly in house music, where I think there was like a change where all of a sudden everyone was into DJing. I feel like growing up, it was all about Eminem and rappers. Uh-huh. And then there was a sort of bit where there was indie had its kind of heyday.
Oh, yeah,
there was kind of like that big sort of indie movement going on, and indie bars were the thing. And I did it like a couple of years as a resident at an indie bar in Clapham. And it was great. Like the setup was kind of like it was basically like one of the tables, which was like a rickety old wooden thing. So my setup would be like wobbling everywhere. But that kind of suited that indie aesthetic. Like, oh, who cares if it gets knocked over? You know, who cares if someone's chucking a drink over there? Oh, it was very kind of like that. And so that wasn't great for my stress levels over the years. Just like, oh. But yeah. And then all of a sudden it was just all about house. And you had people that were going to these nights not really knowing much about house, but they were going because it was trendy. And then that left, like, you know, the birth of these festivals, you know, We Are Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And Eastern Electrics just kept popping up out of nowhere. And all of a sudden this UK house movement became just an absolute Goliath compared to what it was.
Yeah.
And so with that came a lot more DJs, a lot of people that were like, oh, I'm going to DJ now as well. Okay, yeah, cool. And there were some that did then become really, really great. And then there's some that have been part of like a collective where those brands, because they've made it to a certain point, they're kind of like, okay, we've got those DJs that we know work. We're just going to have those DJs every time. And so I think that's led to a lot of sort of feeling of like uninspired within the industry. I'd say that's the biggest challenge is, maybe getting a new event out or something that's a little bit different from the norm, because it seems like a lot of agents and a lot of venues, a lot of companies are probably too scared to maybe go in a different direction.
Yeah.
Because they know what works. They know an Abode or a Defected is going to sell out, irrespective of if everyone plays an average set. I'm not saying that they would play an average set, but it's just kind of like, it feels like tried and tested is the only way now. So I would say the biggest challenge, that's probably the biggest challenge right now, is trying to get on a same level or be given as big an opportunity as some of these sort of labels that now, yeah, can just basically just carry on with that exact same level of success, despite, you know, who they're booking or where they're playing it's a challenge.
Yeah, gosh, it sounds it. I know what you mean, because when I've gone to events, it seems to be the same lineup and it's the same type of music, and like you said, house just blown up, hasn't it? But I think it'd be good to take some risks. I've always got this saying in my head, risk equals reward. And something new and fresh, and also new talent as well. I think, you know, it's important to go with the times and to take risks, and also, go with someone else for a change.
When I first started on the club circuit in London, I was only sort of DJing in the city for like a year. I'd done cruise ships. That was kind of something I fell into and was DJing for lots of different crowds. Like there was sort of one, the cruise line in particular, which was a lot of older guests. So it was a lot of rock and roll and a lot of, you know, 60s. And that was fine.
Yes.
And then I went and did like some spring break cruises over in the West Coast on near LA.
Wow.
And that was then like an episode of like the OC or something. You know, it was just like all of a sudden it was just like tanned 20-somethings going crazy and me like pasty white kid from England just like, oh, okay, I guess I actually have got a party. And that sort of then put me in good stead for the club circuit, was getting into more house. And then the bookings, which I think my first ever one was Ministry of Sound. It wasn't just about these sort of same names. It was just like lots of sort of little brands were all sort of rotating their lineups, and you just a lot of freshness. There was a lot of freshness about, and it was good because then you'd sort of meet lots of different guys or girls from different, mind you, back in those days, like there weren't as many female DJs, and that is something I've always championed. I've got good friends that are female DJs and they're so great at what they do, and I feel that that's one big positive, is that a light has been shone on female talent in the industry, DJs, singers, producers. They're getting their moment, which is so great. And it's not just the ones that may be scantily dressed, like we were talking, you know, the ones that maybe it's more of an image driven thing. But there's DJs that are there because they're cracking DJs.
Yeah.
And that's so important. But yeah, when I first started, it was like a kind of, you don't have to be a producer. You can just be a DJ. And I know we were speaking before about production is something I have struggled massively with. Mm. It's something where I've had the enjoyment for it, but it's not something that's like my bread and butter, like I feel DJing is. I feel so comfortable with DJing and I feel like I'm home. Whereas production, I feel like if I've gone and learnt with someone, I was in the Tourum Academy, but I didn't finish the course because the pressure was a lot.
Really?
It was very stressful, just because I was learning, but at the same time, I felt like every single time I was in the studio, I was like cramming for an exam. So I was putting too much pressure on myself internally, and going, oh God, like I know I've got the information there, but I don't know if I can do it. So that led to a lot of self-doubt. Now I'm at the stage where I can be comfortable in the studio, but I'm doing it sort of on my terms. And I feel like that's where the best stuff is coming out. But it is still a struggle for me. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I haven't released anything to date, because it's not quite representative of what I'd want to put out. So there's still work to do on that. And yeah, this is something I wanted to say on the podcast as well, that even myself being in the industry for 17 years, production is something that has now become almost mandatory. Whereas before I'd started as just a DJ and a lot of people were doing it just for the love of that. Now there are some exceptions, but if you don't produce, you can only really get so far up the ladder. So there's a pressure that comes with that. And some people have thrived in getting their head down on like a random afternoon and just spending all that time in the studio, like they live and breathe it. It's more of a struggle for me. And I think that's just something that won't ever change. So, you know, that there is pressure, but I feel like I'd like to sort of find people that are in a similar position to me and try and collaborate with those people to say, look, we obviously don't have it as this real natural thing, but maybe we can try and make something where, you know, our uncomfortability becomes comfortable.
Yeah.
And gleaning bits of information off of others that go, oh, okay. And I'm learning this not because I'm in an academy. I'm learning this because I'm just curious about it. So yeah, you know, I've had Ableton. I've bought a Mac and I've had Ableton now for 6 years. Still haven't got a record. But I've produced many pieces of stuff, which they're okay. And I could have probably had releases, but there's not one track that I've made which has ticked all the boxes. And if I'm going to release something and not play it as a Lucas Solis or an El Arpa, then surely that's defeating the object a little bit of making it.
And also, I think, you know, you're a perfectionist, like you said, and, you know, you want your first track to come out to be an absolute banger, to make a stamp on the industry. Mm. So that there is a hell of a lot of pressure. Like you said, you've been in the industry for 17, 18 years, and you've got one track that would be released. So there would be a lot of expectation. I understand why after 6 years you're still going, oh, it's not quite right. It's like the perfect painting, you know, it's like still not quite there. And as you do love to take people on a journey, there will just be probably a hell of a lot of levels going on in a track. I mean, I've never produced a track, obviously, but I have seen videos, and all the tiny little sounds that you're hearing is all being combined. It's just incredible, very overwhelming, I'd imagine.
Well, a lot of people, you know, would say a release is a release, you should get it out. But my counterpoint to that would be, but to get that out, you know, you've got to make the effort of getting in touch with those labels. You've got to have it mastered. You've got to have an artwork made. Then you've got the promotion train that starts with that. Hey, here's my new record. And if you're not 100% proud of it, this is just me. If I'm not 100% proud of that record, I just don't think I could look myself in the mirror and go, that was good that you did that.
Totally get it though.
Yeah. So it's something I think is next on my goals is definitely to look to people that I've met in the industry. You know, I spoke about Amsterdam and Brighton, these events. It'd be good to get in the studio with more people. I've only ever been in the studio with about three people before. And it was more like watching them produce and then, you know, maybe making a little note or, just kind of more of an observer role. But I think it would be great to be in the studio where just start maybe by having a chat, not even opening Ableton at the start, and then just getting little bits of something just from mucking about, maybe, or going, oh, have you tried this synth before? Or did you want to have a go on this? I think it would be good to start with in that direction, and then hopefully something completely original comes off the back of it.
That would be really good, actually, because I guess when you're studying, well, I don't know, how would you actually study doing that? Is it like a classroom? I'm trying to picture how it would be. Or is it like an online course?
So my first, I was doing it through like YouTube videos in the beginning. And then when I approached Tool Room, they were like, yeah, you can come in the studio with Dean Ramirez, who is, you know, like a legend of, you know, he's someone that really lives, breathes it. And he's still DJs occasionally. I saw him in Amsterdam and, we had a nice little sort of catch up but you can tell from him, it's, you know, the production for him is like just everything. He could go without the DJing. Whereas for me, it's the other way around. Mm. I could go without the production, but I couldn't go without the DJ.
Yeah.
That to me is like everything about it. So for me, if I could then find a love of it, maybe through collaborating with others and making something that's more refined, you know, you're in the studio with these people and you're learning stuff about the mechanics of it, whether it's track, you know, building a track through a groove, which is obviously drum beats. And then it's a lot of programming and it's very technical.
Sounds it.
And you can learn a lot about a little, you know, in those moments. But then you're missing that element of originality because, you know, you might be going through some samples and going, oh, I've heard that sample before, but how do I make that unique?
Yeah.
Or how do I turn this groove into something which could then lead to another part of the track? Mm. Yeah. And then there's, you know, that style of it is very formulaic. Whereas I think the bit that I would be missing is the bit that turns it from a formulaic track that has da 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 da, da to going, wow, okay, yeah, this sounds like a track that's just got something else, a different hook, something which has maybe been made by me, myself, like manipulating a sound I've made through a microphone or recording something live or getting a vocalist in. That's the approach I'm going to take on it.
I think that'd be really good, actually, to get people who are, you know, they studied it to an extent, but they're just, like you said, it's based on samples, very much putting you in a box. But you want to break out of that box. You want it to be original. And yeah. I guess it would be comforting if you've got everybody in the same boat who wants to make something new and creative, but it's just, it's all that pressure.
It is. Yeah. Basically the nail on the head is the pressure. Before I just felt it big, and it made me kind of procrastinate and put off going back to the project after I was in the studio, because I felt like, now the pressure's off, just unwind from it, you know, like you spent a long day in the studio, and now you've realized that a few days have gone by and you're like, oh, I don't want to lose that information. So you open the project and you look at the project, but because you don't have that person there, you're kind of like, you're just kind of revising what you've done without really progressing.
Yeah.
So it is intense. And yeah, I think taking it from that view of there's no pressure to make anything, but let's just see if, you know, working with that person in a more relaxed environment can create something different.
Yeah, just exploring all the sounds.
Yeah.
What would you think would be surprising to know?
I would say that one of the biggest surprises to me is that you can get a lot of people that do it alongside another job as a trade, but there's not loads of people that have sort of, particularly in London, I'm speaking for London really, I guess, but there's not a lot of people that have really just gone fully for it, because maybe they see it as a bit of pocket money, you know, but the people that would do like their 9 to 5 and then maybe do a Friday and a Saturday night in central London because a bit of extra cash and love playing out DJing a little bit and kind of as a hobby, I suppose,
yeah.
Which pays. Whereas I took it along the path of I want to be as successful as possible. And yeah, there weren't many of us. When I first started, out of a pool of, I guess, about 150 DJs in an agency, say there were maybe a couple of dozen of us that were doing it like fully. So that surprised me. That surprised me that there were a lot of people that maybe thought it was too much of a gamble. And I learned myself through it that it is a gamble to maybe just to stay on one agency's books. You know, if I could go back to a younger me and say, you know, get network more. And don't be over-reliant on one. Have a backup plan, you know, whether it be DJing or something else. You know, as I said, there were these other DJs that already had a 9 to 5, which was really their main bulk of income.
Yeah.
Whereas you're kind of tempting fate to just say, okay, I'm going to rely on this one agent because she's booking me for loads of work. Go back. Don't fill your diary with one agency's gigs. Don't do that. Get a few because, you know, you don't know what could happen. You don't know if one residency, as I said, could all of a sudden be taken away from you. Build contacts as quickly as you can. You know, don't ever feel relaxed, especially in those first formative years of your DJ career. Don't feel like that you've done enough because a pandemic might happen or a DJ's a manager might all of a sudden know that, oh, actually my best mate who I used to run a club with in Portsmouth has just become available. I'm going to take all my other DJs off the books. I want my best mate in, you know.
Ooh.
You know, there's that can happen. And yeah. it's all of this stuff which is completely out of your control.
Yeah.
And as I said, sometimes you're going to want to react to that and go, that's not fair. It's not fair. But
it isn't fair.
It's just part of it. It's just part of it. And then being able to go, you know, being able to, there's a massive difference from now. If I lose work, it's like, okay, that's fine because there's other work there for me. People know that they can rely on me. I'm experienced enough to play to, you know, most crowds. So, you know, that's fine. But before, you know, you'd get a piece of news like that and you'd be like, oh, well, what now? You know, great. That's money that I'd already had spoken for. So that it's all about that personal growth, you know, about just sort of not getting too down about it, not taking a setback in the right way. Because if you go into yourself at that point, it's probably just going to be more negative. And that the industry can pass you by quite quickly if you do that. So, yeah, thick skin.
Definitely. What would be your absolute biggest piece of advice for someone wanting to be a DJ? Would it be that? I mean, obviously have a thick skin.
But... Yeah, yeah. I would also say as well is just, is before, I think it was about, you know, people for certain genres of music, but if you can learn as much as possible, if you've come from a musical background, amazing, that can hold you in such good stead for a gig where you might have met a contact that might be like, do you know what, I'd love you to play for my birthday party. There's going to be some Japanese guests there. Would you be able to play some Japanese music? And it'd be quite easy to go, oh yeah, and just downloading some Japanese hits. But there'll be times where, you know, if you do know a little bit more about a certain genre which might be unfamiliar, it could lead to something else.
Yeah.
So I'd say, yeah, just do as much homework as you can. Do as, you know, really learn your craft. Obviously, you know, being technically good is one thing, but having taste in your music and knowing your music is so important, particularly if you want to be a multi-genre DJ, a DJ that plays the commercial gigs and the club gigs and a private function corporate event. Become as familiar with your music as possible. Yeah,
definitely. So what's next for you? Got anything big coming up?
Yeah, so I've got a radio show coming up this week on Wednesday night as my El Arpa alias. I'm doing that with my friend Danny, who's DJ name is D Jelly, but he also goes as Memory Muscle. He's just formed a new DJ duo with a friend of his, and he's going to be looking for a new radio show as well. So going to be looking to do more disco events with him, because we both have similar tastes in that genre. So looking forward to sort of jamming with him on the radio in a couple of days. The week after that, we're actually doing a set. I'm going to be playing as Lucas Solis for his club night at Corsica Studios. So that's fun. That'll be my first sort of big Lucas Solis gig of the year. And then looking into the summer, I've got a gig at 93 Feet East, sort of middle of May, I think. So just before summer. And then summer, I'm doing a couple of festivals. And then towards the end of the year, hopefully, there's one gig that's confirmed, but hopefully a little mini tour of Asia.
Wow.
So...
Yeah. Yes, amazing.
Fingers crossed.
Amazing.
On that one, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll have to leave in the show notes where to find you for all of your gigs.
Great.
Luke, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure.
Have you got anything else you want to add to this?
Absolutely not. Just
sign off.
Candy smashing it. Make sure you tune in, guys.
Thank you so much. Luke, what an in-depth and thought-provoking chat. Thank you so much again for being an amazing guest. It was so lovely to hear more about the industry from someone I've known for such a long time. And gosh, didn't we delve deep into some delicate topics? You've simply got to witness a club night with Luke as the DJ. So I've put all the details into the show notes. Thank you all so much. Bye for now.